lighting the way with positive energy and love. HRNradio.com.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Powell to the People, live on the radio. I'm Wayne Powell, and we have a really exciting and informative show for you today. We have the multi-talented Peter Landecker, an accomplished concerto violinist, scuba diver, astronomer, astrophysicist, photographer, world traveler, and a number of other things, which we'll get to. Welcome, Peter.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, I want to make an event announcement. Actually, it's Peter, but Peter would like to invite everyone to come to the Beach City Symphony Special Concert at El Camino College's Marcy Auditorium. And for those of you who are not from the area, that's in Torrance, California, on May 24th, starting at 6 p.m. for a free party, and then after the party, there's a free classical music concert. The event details are the free party with food, prizes, goodies, and his final concert after 25 years, not Peter's, but Maestro Barry Brisk, where they say a fond farewell. Barry Brisk is retiring as conductor of the Beach City's Symphony Orchestra. And, you know, wow, after 25 years, that's a long time. After the party, the party starts at 6 p.m., and then after that, there'll be a really good concert starting at 8 p.m., featuring four competition prize-winning artists of the future, each performing a movement from a concerto, along with the orchestra playing, and I'm probably going to screw this up, Berlioz. Close. And Rimsky-Korsakov. If you want further information, you can go to beachsymphonies.org.
Beachcitysymphony.org.
Oh, I knew there was a city in there. For further information and directions. All right. Well, I want to start out with, playing the violin. I worked for a couple of record companies in my lifetime. I was, either the financial controller or the CFO, and one of them was a boutique record label, and they had a classical sub-label, and, I've always been rock-oriented. I loved rock music, and classical music, nah, but then once I started listening to it, I loved it, and then I saw a live concert, the great Sarah Chang, at the Music Center, and then had front row seats, got to go behind the stage, and it was in the Maestro's or Empresario room, I guess it was, and talked to her in person, and she was fantastic. And I got an appreciation for classical music, and I really like wind and string instruments, as well as percussion, but particularly string instruments. So, Peter, what made you decide to take up the violin? And you've been doing it for a long time now.
Yes, my mother was a music teacher in New York City, and so I really didn't have much choice. I started playing the piano when I was really quite young, and then later drifted off to the violin. There was a time when I played both the piano and the violin, then just the violin.
Mm-hmm. But it takes a lot of dedication and a lot of practice, to, particularly the violin and the piano.
Yes. It does take a lot of practice to play well, especially if you're learning the instrument.
And I remember the first time I saw a Stradivarius violin, and there's not too many around, and they're pretty old. But I was just in awe of the instrument itself.
Yes. Now, they were built in the 18th century, and there are not that many around. I mean, there's just one guy building the Stradivarius violin, Antonio Stradivarius violins, and he didn't build that many, and there number of them perished over the years, and for one reason or another. So though people take really good care of them, there aren't that many Stradivarius violins. But there are other violins of comparable quality that people do play.
We were at an event recently at the Manhattan Beach Art Center, and you know, I was talking about that concert that, you know, I just mentioned, and so after the first movement, everybody started to applaud, like, and the conductor turned around and said, no. And then it turned out that was just one movement. And then it was the next movement, and then everybody started to applaud, and it still wasn't time. At that point, I was afraid to even applaud. I was actually following the crowd. Then finally, when that particular set, you would maybe call it, was done, and everybody's looking at each other, and the conductor turned around and shook his head, and then everybody knew, okay, now it's time.
Different types of music have different standards. In opera, you might give a rousing cheer whenever a particular aria has been sung well. So you don't have to wait until the end of the act to applaud. But in classical music and orchestral music, it's traditional that you wait until the end of the piece, which is after all the movements, and to clap before is not the best thing to do. So if in doubt, wait for other people to clap.
Well, once people started clapping, I just followed in. So that shows how little that I knew at the time. But what was fascinating was, you know, the conductor obviously sets the pace and the tone and the emphasis and all of that. But he also gives the signals for, you know, when the string section or a particular string instruments are about to, you know, do their parts. I mean, they're doing it from sheet music. They're probably doing it from memory. I'm sure they've done that over and over, the professional artists. But, or, you know, it was time for the wind instruments or a section of that or the percussion. So, but it was fascinating seeing all the moving parts that have to come together.
Yes. Yes. A good conductor will cue in a particular player when he's supposed to give his do his major thing if he hasn't been playing for a while, and that's always a good thing. That the players usually would come in anyway at the right time, but it doesn't hurt to help them play at the right time, and that way things go more smoothly. Or it's just an insurance move that things will go well.
And that everybody's in the right key, but of course that's, you know, the sheet music. I thought about, you know, who the composer was and how the tasks they have, you know, considering all the various instruments involved and the different nuances among the various instruments.
Yeah. Sometimes things go wrong and, well, this upcoming concert will have four, winners of contests, these are young kids, and this may be the first time they're playing with an orchestra. They get nervous. I remember once, about 10 years ago, there was a soloist, a young kid, about 10 years old, and he made a mistake, and he skipped ahead a page. And then there was no way that the conductor could really correct that with his hands to cue people in, because things were really, really potentially bad. He could stop and then ask everybody to start at a certain place. Or what ended up happening was that the first bar or two sounded really bad because the soloist was playing one thing and the orchestra was playing the other. but within a bar, we all realized what had went wrong individually, and in two bars, the whole orchestra was playing with the soloist, even though he had skipped a page, and that had never been rehearsed.
Wow. Well, I remember seeing The Who in concert, and Pete Townsend, after each song, he'd have like a stagehand run out, and he'd swap guitars and whatever. Well, he was playing... I can't remember. I think it was Bob O'Reilly, but he was doing the windmill, and then he shook his head and he paused for a second, Then he continued on, and he looked over to the stage right and kind of like shook his head, and he finished the set, and then they swapped out guitars, and he says, oh, by the way, I broke a string. And I remember once at a concert where somebody broke a string, and they were actually performing and or singing, and they were, you know, putting the string on and getting it tuned. Has that ever happened to you on a violin?
No, it hasn't, but it has happened to, when it happens to a soloist, that's very serious. And usually, for example, if it's a violin soloist, the concert master will hand the soloist his violin, and they sort of pass violins forward until the guy in the back can find a spare violin, but at least the show goes on. It can be quite exciting when that happens. It's not clearly not planned.
And then sometimes when things happen like that, or you know, some mishaps, many times the audience perhaps isn't even aware of what's going on, or at least good performers make it that way.
Yes, I hear there was one particularly good violin soloist who broke a string, and it is possible to play with your other strings to make up for it, but it's really hard, and somehow this violinist was good enough so that he was able to pull it off by playing with just three strings. But this doesn't happen very often, and it's almost an impossible task.
Well, I know drummers, particularly in rock bands, have a number of drumsticks because I've seen one or two break during a performance. Plus, I don't think they let it get to that point. If they, you know, they use it for a limited period of time, and then, you know, they'll throw it out to the audience as souvenirs.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like that would be at a, you know, orchestra concert, but. So how often do you practice in, anticipation or prior to a concert?
Well, our orchestra practices once a week for about 6 or 8 weeks before each concert, and that's the primary time when I learn the music.
And I guess it takes a while for everybody to, I don't want to say be on the same page, but to be in sync with each other and have the, you know, the rhythm and the nuances and all of that.
Yes. It's easier for professional players. They don't need to practice for 6 weeks. They can just, in less than one rehearsal, do the difficult parts and then play the performance that evening or the following day. Our community orchestra sounds almost as good, but we need lots of practice. There's no way that we could just play one rehearsal and then play the concert, because we would not sound very good if we did that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the professional ones, like at the Music Center or the Boston Pops or Boston Symphony, and all of those, particularly the ones that are traveling around the country and they're doing different sets all the time. How does that work? I mean, do they, I assume they also have rehearsals as well?
Yes, well, if it's a group that's playing together, some popular groups that now I'm not talking about symphony orchestras, but the groups have a repertoire and they play it maybe not every night, but every week or every 2 weeks, and so they know it pretty cold and just can play it because they're so familiar with it, and they're professionals.
And I remember, I can't remember what instrument it was, but I was at a concert, an orchestra concert, and the one person I just happened to look at wasn't even really looking at the sheet music. It was like all in her head. But they also have understudies, I assume. So if someone gets sick the night of the performance or something happens, what's the dynamics when that understudy has to step in?
Well, of course, if it's the soloist, then you have to get somebody at the last minute who can, who knows the piece that's going to be played and knows it cold and can, and has to be available and can get to the concert location. And that's a challenge. If you're a violinist, say first or second, or any string player, if one player gets sick at the last minute, you know, you're in a section of, say, in the case of a first violin, there are maybe 10 first violins. So if one doesn't show, you still can put on, it's not panic time. If you're a woodwind, then you really do have to get you really do need an understudy who's available at the last minute who can play the part. Cause for woodwinds and brass, there's usually, you're the only one playing that particular part.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been doing this for, about 40 years?
Yes.
Is there a particular composer or a composition that you like, or, I mean, that is like your most favorite, and is there one that you, shun or would not like to perform?
Well, yeah, we all have personal preferences of the types of music we like to listen to, and for me, it's classical music in the classical and romantic periods, so... composers like Mozart and Beethoven, Brahms, Bach, Mendelssohn, these are my favorites.
Mm-hmm. All the greats, that are performed over and over. Well, I want to shift gears. One of the things, on your Facebook page, we have some cool photos of you playing the violin, but you also have scuba diving photos, one of which was, I think that was your 2000th dive, and you were, there was a photo of a wrecked boat. And you were, and I think, wait, you're up to like well over 2,100, 2,200
dives? Yeah, I think I'm over 2,200 dives now.
So, what got you into scuba diving?
Well, I had watched the Cousteau films, that intrigued me. And when I moved out to California, where there's really very good scuba diving, just offshore at some of the islands, I decided I was going to take up scuba diving, and so I did that relatively late in life, in my 30s.
I was actually thinking of you last night. I was I was channel surfing, and there was an old Seinfeld episode that had Lloyd Bridges, and of course, now I'm dating myself, but Lloyd Bridges reminds me of Sea Hunt. And where that's all, you know, he did on every show was scuba diving. And thought maybe that might have something to do with it. But I guess you started that long after.
Yes. Well, it was really the Cousteau films that got me interested into the underwater world. And it is a whole new world. You're weightless. And you can not only go to the right or left or forward or back, but up or down and effortlessly. You can, every dive is different. There are exotic critters down there. So I still enjoy scuba diving. Last month I was diving in a volcanic crater in Nicaragua. and I could actually feel some hot vents when I went down to the bottom, there was hot water coming out of holes in the crater floor.
Well, that's the other thing. You've been scuba diving at several exotic places around the world.
Yes, I have.
Well, we're going to pick up on that when we come back from a commercial break. But first, you're listening to Powell to the People on the Healthy Life Radio Network.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Welcome back. You're listening to Powell to the People. Wayne Powell here, and I'm with the multi-talented Peter Landecker. So talk about the various exotic places that you've scuba dived.
Well, probably my favorite place is the Galapagos Islands, where there's just so much underwater activity that's fascinating. And there are things you could see there that you can't easily see in other places. And above water is also interesting and exotic.
Well, later in the show, we're going to talk about you raise tortoises. Those are desert tortoises, but I'm sure in the Galapagos you've seen a lot of sea turtles.
Well, certainly there are sea turtles in the water, and then there are land tortoises, enormous land tortoises, one for each island. At least that's the way it used to be. And I saw both the underwater turtles and the above water tortoises. In fact, I remember with the above water tortoises, there were two, I don't know, 300, 400, 500-pound tortoises, and they were mating. And then there was this red bird that was on the back of the male, who was on top of the female. That was one of my favorite above water pictures.
Do you have like an underwater camera?
I do. I have an underwater camera which I take with me on every dive.
So you've got probably a really great photography collection.
I do.
I remember I did in the Bahamas, and we were like by a coral reef. We, you know, dove off of the ship, and then before I knew it, we were at a distance from the ship, like the point of no return. And I bought one of those disposable plastic underwater cameras, which actually took some really cool photos, but it was like, I was starting to get a bit exhausted, and I look, and it's like the boat is a lot. And there was, of course, a dive master or an instructor, but it was nothing like, you know, where you're going below the water for sustained amounts of time. And then, you know, you got to keep track of how much oxygen you have. You don't want to go up too fast because you don't want to get the bends.
Yes.
Have you ever been around sharks?
Oh, all the time. I love sharks. They're beautiful creatures, and I do like to be around sharks. In the Galapagos Islands, I mentioned that they had a lot of sea life, and one of the things they had at Darwin Island was schooling hammerheads, and a lot of them. And so in fact, there were so many that when I did a backflip off the small boat, I landed on one. Now, that was quite exciting, especially for the shark.
And it didn't freak the shark out?
Oh, I'm sure it freaked the shark out, yes. I mean, it freaked the shark out. And I never knew what I hit, but it had to be hammers, because it had to be a hammer, because there were just so many in the water. So there's probably a hammerhead shark in the Galapagos that went to his chiropractor and said, I don't know what, I was just innocently swimming along near the surface and this big tanky thing fell on my back and I haven't felt the same since.
Well, but don't you get scared? I mean, if I were to do a dive, I'd want to make sure there weren't any sharks around, not doing a dive knowing that there were sharks in the vicinity.
You can tell from the I think I can tell from the shark's behavior which sharks are a danger and which aren't. Unless you do something to the shark, like grab its tail or try to confine it in a hole, most sharks will be quite afraid of divers, or certainly they won't attack divers. The humankind kills several hundred million sharks every year, and sharks kill a few people every year, less than 10. So if you're going by the odds, it's better to be a person.
I would think if I'm going to be anywhere underwater near sharks, I'd want to be in a shark cage or whatever, especially if the sharks are hungry.
Yes. Well, there are some situations where you're in a cage, but very few. Mostly, most sharks are very docile.
Hmm. Well, I know when I did the snorkeling, and there were all kinds of various schools of colorful fish. They gave us a chart in advance so we could identify them. And at one point, I was swimming amongst, it seemed like a gazillion really colorful fish, and it was really cool. And they were all friendly, and they didn't, I guess they were accustomed to people. And I'm sure it's that way when you're scuba diving.
Yes, yes.
When you are down there, I guess you have to always be aware of your surroundings, and then also, I guess, the time that you're below the water, you know, keeping an eye on the oxygen.
Yes, it's not really oxygen, it's air. In the old days, when I first started diving, it was a little more dangerous. You didn't really have a pressure gauge even on your tank, and so you didn't really know how much air you had. There was a lever you could pull, and that would give you a reserve, but that's only if the reserve was working or if it was in the right position. And now things are much safer. There are not only pressure gauges, but there are dive computers that are to tell you exactly how long you can safely be at the place you are underwater at all times, and it updates continuously. So it's fairly easy to avoid problems. I've never had a diving accident, but that's because I'm very careful and I do listen to my computer.
And is there like a maximum depth because of the pressure that you can get to?
It depends. If you're first starting to dive, you probably shouldn't go more than a few tens of feet. For recreational divers, 130 feet is considered as far down as you should go. But I've been down to 200 feet a couple of times, and I think I've done it safely. You have to know what you're doing. The sea is unforgiving, and since I know a little physics, that helps me with making it safe for me to dive.
And you don't want to come up too quickly, although I guess they have hyperbaric chambers that if you do get the bends, but you don't ever want that.
Yeah, they're things that you learn when you're trained to dive. You can't, if you have too much nitrogen in your body and then you come to the surface, you can get the bends. If you come up too fast and you're holding your breath, you can get an embolism. That's really bad. There are things that can go wrong, but if you follow the rules, then I'm nervous about driving, and it's more dangerous for me to, it sounds crazy, but I it's safer for me to be diving than to drive to the dive site.
Well, because when you're driving, you have to be concerned about others.
Yes. So
what's the most interesting or unusual thing that you've encountered in your dives?
I've had some interactions with large animals, and that's been special. I've many different animals. I felt like I was communicating with them, and they were communicating with me, and that I consider very, very, very unusual and very special.
It seems like they were probably just as curious about you as you were about them.
Yes.
Wow. Well, someday I'd like to see some of those photos. I've seen a couple on Facebook, but that doesn't really give it any justice. Anyways, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Powell to the People on the Healthy Life Radio Network.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to Powell to the People. Wayne Powell here, and I'm with the multi-talented Peter Landecker. So one thing that's really interesting is you were an astrophysicist and you worked on the NASA programs. Talk about that.
Yes, I did a number of things in my career. One thing I did was working at the bottom of the deepest mine in the world, looking for neutrinos in South Africa. The lab site was over 2 miles underground. That's an example of an unusual location for doing a physics experiment. I also worked at a number of institutions and studied the sun or the stars. in X-rays or in other at other wavelengths. And so I was working on instruments that flew on satellites and then analyzed the data from those instruments. That was very exciting.
When you were down, you know, deep, were you ever afraid there could be a collapse? Or, you know, what was it like way down in a...
Oh, well, yes. In the working areas of the... this was a gold mine. The working areas, the extreme pressures and the lack of supporting of the ceilings meant that there were going to be collapses and injuries and deaths. In fact, they didn't have accident-free shifts. They had fatality-free shifts they were keeping track of. And it was scary. But we had a very safe laboratory away from the main working area of the mine, but it was at the bottom. It went off in a different direction away from the gold. And that was reinforced so well that I was not really afraid of any kind of collapse where I was spending most of my time.
Well, you know, you always hear about mine collapses, but with physics, and I remember when I took physics in high school and chemistry, and occasionally one of our experiments would go terribly wrong, and one time it was in chemistry where I was cleaning out some beakers and I mixed some things that I shouldn't have and there was an explosion. Fortunately, I was wearing, you know, protective gear. Have you ever encountered a physics experiment or any type of experiment that went terribly wrong or didn't go as it was planned?
Well, yeah, certainly experiments don't always go as planned, but I've never had any kind of catastrophic problem. I was lucky.
A couple of years ago, or maybe a few years ago, I had had Danny Olivas, the astronaut who lives in Manhattan Beach. He's done a number of spacewalks and, you know, been on the International Space Station. When you were doing work for NASA, and hopefully now I'm not asking you questions that are classified information, what were some of the things that you did?
Well, one of the things I did was worked on an instrument that looked at the sun and looked for solar flares and try to predict when solar flares might occur. Solar flares can be damaging to mankind in many ways, disturbs geospace and can affect people on the ground as well as in orbit. And you really want to be able to predict when a big solar flare will occur. That's very helpful. And it's interesting to study the sun in its own right, even not considering its potential for disruption of human life. So I was doing those kinds of things.
I know solar flares are very disruptive for telecommunications. When we had the last solar eclipse, and they were telling everybody, don't look at the sun. You know, there's ways you can have devices that project onto, you know, a piece of paper or onto a photographic medium, but you don't look directly into the sun, yet there were still people. It's not the same like a lunar eclipse.
Well, a solar eclipse can be quite dangerous. Looking at the sun can be quite dangerous. I mean, you know, you could take a magnifying glass and you could magnify the image of the sun at a point, and you can start a fire. And if you put your eye at that point, you can blind yourself. That's not good at all. So it's important when you look at the sun during an eclipse to have eye protection. Ways of attenuating the sun, which is quite bright, so that it doesn't damage your eye, and also that there's some rays that can damage your eye and you can't see, and so you want to make sure those don't damage your eye either.
I remember going on a tour at Northrop Grumman of the Webb, the James Webb Space Telescope, being inspected. It was been, you know, It was in final assembly, and and then there was one guy that was standing there. He looked like a CIA or FBI agent, but he was making sure the tour guide didn't say anything that was classified, or when we asked questions, he would say, "I can't answer it for them," you know, because of that. But they were talking about how this telescope is going to look out light years that preceded us, you know, to give a perspective of how the universe was formed. And then they talked about there was like a demonstration where we're just like a little pin dot in the bigger picture scheme of things, you know, the universe. And I couldn't sleep that evening just thinking about, you know, looking back at, you know, light years before us, or how we're just like, I remember as a kid, you have like a jar and you would have insects or an ant farm, and you know, that was like a little minutia of a much bigger universe, and then we're like the minutia of a much bigger universe. Talk about that.
Well, when you look up and see the stars, the night sky, you're not seeing the light that was just produced. You're seeing light that could have been produced millions of years ago, or thousands of years ago. You don't really, the star might not be there right now, but you're still seeing the starlight from it. And because of the time delay, the speed of light is a finite quantity, and the universe is very large. So the light you're seeing was produced typically millions of years ago. The other thing you mentioned was having to do with looking back at the Earth, it being insignificant. The great Carl Sagan, one of my mentors, was in the Voyager program, had asked that the camera be aimed back at the Earth, and nobody could figure out, well, why would you want to look at the Earth? But it was just a pale blue dot, and that And Carl realized how insignificant the Earth was, and that all that we fight over on Earth, when you go into space and look back, you don't see geopolitical boundaries. We're just one little small part of the universe.
About a week or two ago, I think it was the 50th anniversary of landing on the moon, you know, in 69, and they had a documentary on TV. Actually, there's this, I think it's a six-part series on ABC on Tuesday nights, and so that 1 hour, that first episode was about the moon and some of the things that you know, went wrong, and all of the trajectories that they had to calculate. And I'm going to hold that thought because I'm getting the signal that we got to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Powell to the People on the Healthy Life Radio Network.
All positive natural health programs on HRNradio.com.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
It's Powell to the People. Welcome back. You're listening to Powell to the People. It's Wayne Powell here, and I'm with the multi-talented Peter Landecker. So finishing up on the Apollo 11 story, they were talking about all of the calculations. My dad was an engineer at the time, and of course he did everything with a slide rule because they didn't have pocket calculators. And apparently today's smartphones can do a lot more calculations much quicker and with limited space than the large onboard computers that they had. But they also had people that were calculating trajectories, and so there was some room potentially for human error, and there were a number of glitches. When I had Danny Olivas, the astronaut, you know, that lives in Manhattan Beach on the show, and he says, just like any airline pilot will tell you that, you know, when you're dealing with mechanical stuff or even electronics, and of course human interactions, there's things that always go wrong, and you have backup plans and scenarios. And when you were working for the NASA program, did you get involved in a lot of things that, that involved the physics of, metals and electronics and atoms and all of that kind of stuff?
Didn't really get involved at that basic level, put together parts that make an instrument. But things do go wrong with instruments, and you can't really fix them very easily. You're not going to be able to fix the James Webb telescope after it's been launched, because it'll be in an orbit that's way beyond where an astronaut could reach. So what you have to do when you're designing an instrument and you want it to last is you have to design redundancy. And we certainly, anybody designing space hardware worries about redundancy. What redundancy means is, if one power supply dies, you'd be able to switch to another supply. If one detector dies, you should be able to switch to a different detector. And that way, if there are some problems, you can recover from not every problem, but from many problems.
And I know for airline pilots, they go into simulators, they have a manual on board, and you're right, they have, secondary and tertiary redundant equipment, so for significant systems. Well, now I want to shift gears, because I remember a number of years ago when I was at your house and you raised desert tortoises, and I think at the time I was there, it wasn't for that, but they were, I probably didn't get to see them because they were in hibernation, but talk about the work that you do with tortoises.
Well, I have California desert tortoises in my backyard. They are endangered in the wild, but they're not endangered in my backyard. I have, in fact, too many. I just gave away three to the local turtle and tortoise club. Now I have six. But there was a time when I had as many as 20. I was given an original pair by somebody who was moving up to the mountains and couldn't take care of them. And I had babies, and the babies had babies, so I have three generations of tortoises living in my backyard. I dug up the eggs and incubated them because it's a little too cold in Manhattan Beach for the eggs to normally hatch on their own. And as a result, I ended up with many tortoises. They're interesting pets. They're have no fear of me. They're used to me, and so they sort of follow me around the backyard.
Well, I remember relatively recently, somebody posted on Facebook or Nextdoor that there was a tortoise, and it was on the east side of Manhattan Beach, and they didn't know, they were trying to locate the owners, and the first thing that came to mind was you, and I sent you an email. It wasn't one of yours, it was somebody else's. I guess they're all contained within an area, so.
Yeah, you really need a tortoise-proof backyard, because if there's a way that tortoises can get out, even though the grass is greener literally in your backyard, they'll want to explore the world, and the world can be dangerous to them because of cars and lawnmowers and other terrible things for tortoises. Tortoises do hibernate in the wintertime, typically for about 5 months. I put them in newspapers and dry in the garage and boxes, and for 5 months they don't eat, they don't drink, they don't move, they just lose a little of their body weight, and then when they start moving again in the spring, I bring them out and let them run around my backyard.
How large do they grow to?
The biggest one I have is 12 pounds.
Oh, okay. I remember when I was a kid, and I was, I think, at a zoo, and there was a tortoise that was so big you could actually ride on it as a kid.
Yes. Yeah, the tortoises in the Galapagos, for example, are really large, and really large meaning they're several hundred pounds, and you shouldn't ride on them, but you could if you had to. I mean,
and they live a number of years?
Yeah, if you're a dog or a cat person, You have a number of dogs and cats in your lifetime, but if you're a tortoise, you have a number of owners in your lifetime, because they typically live about 100 years and longer than people.
So in your will or family trust, you have provided for their care?
I actually have. What I've done in my case is I've given... They're usually local turtle and tortoise societies that have an adoption program. So they go to somebody's house that wants to adopt a tortoise, and they make sure that the environment is going to be good for the tortoise. And then if it is, then they'll give the tortoise to that family. So I in fact have in my living trust that my tortoises will go to the local turtle and tortoise club.
It's kind of like parrots that live 60 to 80 years old, you know, particularly macaws. So it's the same concept. What do you feed them?
Well, let's see. I have a housekeeper, and she sort of adopted the tortoises. She comes once a week, and she brings some goodies that she gets from the local supermarket. They like fruits and vegetables, but even if she doesn't come around, they could survive quite well on the grass and the weeds in my backyard.
Oh, well, we're getting near the end of the show. You have a website that you can give our listeners?
Sure. It's tinyurl.com/pblandecker. So that's tinyurl.com/pblandecker.
All right. Well, we'll be right back to wrap things up. You're listening to Powell to the People on the Healthy Life Radio Network.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Powell to the People. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guest, Peter Landecker. This has been very informative. Next week, we have Fred Miniger, mayor of Laguna Niguel, and I look forward to another exciting show. I want to thank you for listening to Powell to the People, and always remember, power is the ability to do good things for others and make your community and the world a better place. This is Wayne Powell sending you positive thoughts and good wishes. Have a great week. We'll see you back next Monday, same time, same place. Until then, bye for now.